everyone, and welcome to this very, very special episode of Partners in Time. I'm here with my co-host Chris Granger-Hare. Hey Chris, how are you?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
Very, very well. And we have some celebrating to do. 50 years or episodes? Is it years or episodes?
it's in fast forward COVID time. It probably feels like 50 years. And honestly, I nearly fell off my chair when I read it's 50 episodes already. But
it is a lot.
What a journey it's been.
Yeah, absolutely. Our podcast Partners in Time has his 50th episode, and we're here sitting, and we kind of want to travel a little bit back in time and talk about the special episodes. And I have a couple of things that I remember. You have a couple of things that you remember. For me, it's been really, really an interesting journey because in each episode, I learned a lot, especially about the IWC world, about the watchmaking world. But it was also always a great pleasure to listen to your episodes whenever you had guests talking over there. So it's been a win-win situation on my side of things.
It's been amazing. I think when you look at many of the Watch World and independent podcasts, of course, that really focus on product, and all the people around it. It's been amazing to open it up a little bit, and because you know we're gonna come back to it in a minute when we talk about the Hans Zimmer episode, which of course I have to mention first. That's absolutely clear. But he talked about the receiving end of a product of craftsmanship becoming part of the story and part of the circle, and I think that's really what happened in Partners in Time. That when you extend the universe to all of the people that interact with the brand and interact with the products, and all the characters that come together through the shared passion for mechanical watchmaking. I personally think it's a really interesting, different perspective rather than just talking about product manufacturing, design, and so on. And I hope that it's an interesting offering for our friends.
2 years ago, we released the very, very first episode. Do you still remember with whom? And do you remember something about that episode?
Yeah, now how could I forget? I mean, Lewis Hamilton, opening Partners in Time. Obviously, this is one way to get started. So you're completely new to the world of podcasting, and your first guest is Lewis Hamilton, who is so eloquent and so to the point that you just automatically, your nerves are just absolutely laid bare in this situation. But we got through it somehow, I think.
And you did a good job.
Yeah, no, I remember. I mean, it was amazing insight. Sometimes it really surprises me what is actually coming out in this podcast situation that you never knew and you don't expect. So Lewis obviously talked about his first serious mechanical watch or first serious watch that he thought was classically elegant, which he bought in Argos of all places. And obviously me remembering my Argos days back in the day, I had problems staying on the chair at that point because I have fond memories. You know, Argos, for those listeners who don't know what Argos is, it's a catalog shop. So this was e-commerce click and collect from back in the day. Yeah. So you walked into a little sort of bare room. There were rows and rows of laminated 2000 page catalogs. And then little notepads with pencils, and you had to basically note down a 6-digit order number for something you wanted, write it down on a piece of paper, hand in the piece of paper at a very sort of hostile looking counter, and then somebody would appear from a warehouse in a brown cardboard box and hand you your actual order. So this was sort of e-commerce for beginners. So the idea that Lewis Hamilton ordered his first status symbol watch from Argos was quite interesting, but I'm sure we're going to listen to a snippet of that.
Yeah, I prepared a snippet, and he's talking about his watch collection in his childhood and his very first one. And that's a different story, but it made him very proud. So let's listen to that little 1 minute snippet.
It was very, very classy, very, way too old.
Classical.
It's super classic kind of look, way too old for a young kid. But I honestly, I remember wearing it and feeling empowered when I had it. I was like, when people see this is kind of, this is a cool looking watch rather than the plastic things that the other kids were having. And it was £9.
Baby G's.
it was literally £9 for the, I think it was £9.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, £19, I think it was.
Lido, that bought you a house back in those days.
Yeah. I was definitely really proud of it. The real one I had was before that was a Mickey Mouse watch. Cause I went to Disneyland when I was like five.
Those are cool.
Yeah, so.
My kids are still wearing these smart bands from Disney World, that gets you all the keyless access to stuff. And that doesn't even show the time, but they still wear it because they're so in love with their Disney experience still from 2 years ago.
Yeah, I really like those childhood stories, and it's nice to hear these kind of childhood. Yeah.
My mom had a Mickey Mouse watch. I didn't tell her it's in the episode, but my mom, being, you know, a graduated lawyer with her own practice, well established, she wore a Mickey Mouse watch.
Yeah, but I mean, it's so interesting to see the human side of Lewis, for example, like how he grew up and how human he is, and how he interacted with it. Because normally they're like superstars and they're going in corners with high speed, crazy, like they're basically stuntmen. But I had kind of a similar story.
Yeah,
with George,
I was going to say, perfect
Russell.
Segue.
Yeah, totally. So I want to listen to it first, and then let's talk a little bit about it.
At the time, you look at these guys as if they're superheroes. You know, I remember I was at an award ceremony, and I think it was the same year, coincidentally, 2009, when Braun had won the championship, and obviously Ross Braun being the co-founder. And I remember he was at this award ceremony, and just totally coincidentally, we were went to the bathroom at the same time, and as this 11-year-old kid, I couldn't believe Ross Braun went to the toilet. I don't know what I thought, but I thought, like, I thought these superheroes, you know, didn't do those things. I don't know. And it's, I'll always remember that, thinking, you know, wow, Ross Braun went to the toilet. Like, it's crazy. It's only now that I'm in Formula One and I see all of these guys and I, you know, obviously all insanely talented, but they're just normal human beings at the end of the day. And that's something that I've only learned since I arrived into Formula One.
It's quite funny. I mean, it is, it must be. It's so nice to envision George sitting there and like learning the reality of life, of Formula One life.
And then realizing that not all things that happen in Formula One toilets are superhero-like.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been to some. We spend a fair amount at race weekends. And I've washed my hands several times next to drivers who are ready to go and stuff. Like, and you're like, should I let him through? He's probably a little bit more time precious. Yeah. I guess you have had the same situation.
Yeah, right? It's the meeting point in Formula One. I mean, in the paddock. I mean, and you kind of have to pretend the whole time like it's sort of the most normal thing on earth. Like you can't go all fanboy on these people on the you know, in the middle of the toilet. They just won't go down very well. But I actually remember the first person I met in Formula One was probably Ross Braun. I think even before I met Nico Rosberg, I think pretty much the first introduction would have been Ross back in the day when he was in charge of Mercedes. So I can totally relate to that.
In the restroom as well?
No. I don't think. I think it was Brackley in the office.
I think one of the first pictures I ever took of Nico in F1 was on day one in the mirror, because like mirrors and washing hands is always kind of a nice setup. And I did like documentary style photos of it. So I asked him, like, can I take a picture of this? And because he's in full race kit, you know, so it's a little weird situation and visually very strong. What I did not realize, he said, yeah, that's okay, but wait a second. I'm like, okay, because there was another driver peeing in the back of it using the urinals, and Nico had the foresight of seeing it and saying, like, you can't take pictures right now, like, you have to wait until he was ready. It was a Ferrari driver, so like there we waited for that and we waited to clear the background, and then I took that picture. And I still very, very vividly remember the story about Toto and his toilet manager. Did he ever tell you that story?
No, he didn't tell me the story. The toilet manager? No.
Yeah, he was the first one who hired a single person and valued him very, very much. And he actually told that story in Harvard. So he taught a class in Harvard Business School, and he talked about like his love for detail and his pretty, like, he's addicted to optimizing every single detail. And because it's a highly sponsorship, high-end surrounding, he was very keen on keeping the toilet clean. Because he said that's a place where we show our craftsmanship on the highest level and everything. And he was not totally happy when he started in F1 with Mercedes of the level of clean, how clean the toilets were. So he hired a person and valued him super far, much. And he's still with the team today. And it's kind of interesting And they talked lots about micromanaging. And is that micromanaging or is it?
It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. And I can only assume that from that day forward, he only ordered Toto toilets. But okay, that's a flat joke. But having said that, you know, my background is in interior design. And I was I was taught by my boss at the time to always make toilets and bathroom environments extra super special. And we never tried to say, okay, this is the concept for the space. And then we have the toilets as an add-on, which are kind of sort of a lower tier version of the main space. We always changed the entire concept completely and made the toilets spectacular. And I do agree, it makes a big, big difference to how you perceive a brand. And to that point, I visited a couple of years ago one of the major industry captains, executive toilet facilities at a corporate headquarter, which shall not be named. And when you walk into there, and it's basically like the most basic hospital-styled bathroom experience, it does make you wonder, right? Whether somebody who claims that they're all into luxury, etc., whether that's actually for real. So I totally, totally agree with Toto's viewpoint that this attention to detail in the bathroom environment is absolutely important.
And you guys do have, I very vividly, I mean, Toto is one of my most impressive, like one of the people I learned the most in my life.
Likewise.
So I really look up to him. And but I would call him a friend as well as you would call him a friend. But I vividly remember the podcast recording with Toto. Where
well-mannered in the toilet, not so well-mannered at the racetrack at times.
So he told a story about his temper, I would say. So let's listen to that story for a little bit in a little throwback to the episode with Toto.
Last year, when I got more excited in the race, I got a watch that could sustain 20 Gs, and that was necessary.
That they really changed after you hit, like, I've seen you on TV. So you hit the desk when you got mad, which is good that you hit the desk and not something else. But IWC called you after that and said, we may need to change the watch on your wrist.
Yeah, it was quite funny because Chris Granger, who runs IWC, we have established a really close relationship, and he said, I have something that you need. And I said, what is it? And he said, it's a watch that can sustain your tantrums. It's a watch that can sustain 20,000 Gs. And I got a Big Pilot's watch shock absorber XPL in our green racing collars. And I'm so thankful. I've been wearing it all along, and it hasn't got any scratch, nor is it being damaged.
That's one of the best stories I've ever heard. Is it true? And tell me a little bit about your friendship with Toto, please.
Well, absolutely. No, I totally, like you already said, you know, I look up to him massively. He's one of my key mentoring friends over the years. I think when we first met back in 2017 in Barcelona at testing, you know, we had a very nice connection from the beginning, and it's developed very strongly ever since. And I think he's somebody who has a unique skill in understanding people very, very profoundly, and being able to really parachute into a situation, identify with any got a sort of given problem, and really come up with very, very good advice extremely quickly, which is very, very impressive. But of course, this amount of intellect and passion often comes with a lot of emotion as well. I can totally identify with that as well. And there was this situation, I think it was the Hungarian Grand Prix back in 2019, I would guess. And there was this overtaking moment. It's on YouTube everywhere. You can find it. And Toto at the time was wearing a Ceritanium Top Gun double chronograph. And you can really see in slow motion all the Insta clips how he gets so excited about this overtaking moment that he's basically just whacks the table full force with his wrist. And obviously, you're generating acceleration forces of 1500 G plus when you do that kind of thing. So I thought, okay, here we are. We have to create some special equipment. And then, you know, at the time we had this world record shock absorber watch in the works, and I knew I had to make one with the Petronas colored BMG spring in the center, just to give Toto something that really resists all of those incidents and the subsequent ones with the headsets, etc. What followed since, it's been a faithful companion for Toto. So a story I really, really liked.
It's so amazing, those relationships with the team as well as with other partners.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the podcast...
There was one thing, if you don't mind me just mentioning that, because I often get asked that when I speak to journalists or customers, and you wouldn't believe how much influence in our designs actually comes from the people like Toto, like Lewis around the brand, giving us inputs. You know, whether it's people like Matt Jones, our Spitfire pilot, specifying exactly what he needs in a watch. It's not marketing. This is absolutely real. You know, and people say, well, did he actually help design this watch? I said, yes, of course. I mean, we have WhatsApp chains of like 600 messages going back and forth of ideas and concepts. You know, people wear these objects on their skin and they're hugely passionate about, you know, the kind of objects they wear. So it's a lot of these influences, including what happened with the shock absorber and what continues to happen with that, they are inspired by the people around the brand. And it's that, for me, that makes the story so exciting.
There's also, like, I've been quite surprised in several times when I listen to your episodes with guests you hosted, that people have things in common, or your guests and have things in common. I wouldn't expect, to be honest. Like one of the people was David Fisher. So, and he's like, he's the coolest, influential person I've ever met in my whole life. So, like, but do you remember what you had in common with him?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, we found out that we basically went to the same shops as teenagers. But let's have a listen back at that moment.
Yeah,
and I had no idea.
Where did you have a Foot Locker back in those days? I mean, I had one in Frankfurt, but I had to travel to that, basically.
Same thing. Exactly. So I was, at that time, I was living outside of Frankfurt, actually.
Oh, so we went to the same Foot Locker, Hauptwache, huh?
Exactly. That yeah. That's exactly the Foot Locker I went to and where I picked up my first pair of Air Force Ones. And I will never forget them. It was a navy blue pair, mid-top Air Force One,
yeah.
And the ankle strap had an American flag on it. And it was...
There you go.
Yeah, it was a very special sneaker for me. And I remember, funnily, a few moments like that, funnily, all in that Foot Locker.
Yeah.
You know, like the Air Max 97, yeah. That silver Nike shoe was a huge deal, because that was the first time where I really, really remember spending... I mean, for that age, especially a considerable amount of money on a sneaker. That was a lot of money.
Definitely.
And so, yeah. So I think that's my first sneaker experience.
That's amazing. That's so cool, because, you know, in the end, my mom actually refused to go into that Foot Locker. So I would go in there because she found it way too stressful. You know, this is the time before social distancing. And this store was, even back then, was very much packed. And she would send me in there. She would let me do my thing. And then ultimately, if I could twist her arm to buy me a pair, she would come in and pay for them. But she would not go into the store.
I was fascinated by the store, by the product. But to be honest, also because of the skateboarders in front of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it was such a cool place, you know, because you had all these skaters there, you know, all these cool looking kids. And so I would, you know, was almost hypnotized, you know, when I would go there. And
especially, you know, memories.
Yeah, totally. And especially being a kid that didn't live in town. You know, I was like living half an hour outside of town, you know, so it was an even bigger deal, I suppose.
Definitely.
I mean, Hauptwache, Foot Locker, Frankfurt, birthplace of IWC and Heisnerbeit.
But it probably is, you know, because I think David was absolutely spot on. It was that skateboard street style park in front of it, which was basically the upper level of that tube station, the metro station down at Hauptwache. And I do think that this really probably shaped my ideas and expectations around retail experience. It probably really did, because they were immersive experiences, because you suddenly had this influx of American culture being brought in. You had these people who were basically dressed up like referees in their black and white stripy kit. There was an energy to this place where the street style came together with the sneakers and streetwear that was really quite something. So it's a funny little episode, but talking about having things in common, I think this was only a half of what happened in the episode you hosted with Alex Eichen. Do you want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, let's listen to it. I mean, I think I mean, you just scored a 1-0 if we're talking soccer or football. But I think I scored a double goal with what Alex and I had in common.
Absolutely.
And I might top that, the Hauptwache in Frankfurt. But let's listen to it. It's been insane. I proposed to my wife of 17 years now in Positano, by the way.
So did I. I proposed to my wife on the beach in Positano 12 years ago. Where did you propose? Good. Where in Positano did you propose?
I made it. I mean, number one, I've been 22. So like it was early. So I
chose. I was 22 as well. Oh my God, a lot of similarities.
Very good. And I choose the Cernus on the terrace there on New Year's Eve. And I'm claiming the fireworks I organized. So like I went down on the knee at exactly 1 minute to midnight. And then when she said yes, the fireworks started. So that was good timing, to be fair.
Yeah, that tops Foot Locker any day. And actually, you know, listening back to that, I can't quite compete with you guys, but obviously as an engagement present after I proposed to my wife, we got a trip to Positano. So
no way.
Yes. As an engaged couple, not quite 22, as I was a little bit more senior than that. But
okay.
But yeah, Positano it was.
That's amazing. And how did you propose?
I proposed in Seefeld in Tirol in Austria. My wife at the time, you know, she worked a summer season in Seefeld. We always went there for cross-country skiing. It's an absolute paradise. We loved the hotels. And I had it all planned out. And I was saying, this was the most nervous I've ever been in my entire life. I was an absolute wreck. And of course, the entire hotel and restaurant were in on it. And basically, we had 13, 14 members of staff just staring at us the entire mealtime and me not being able to eat a single bite. And Paula was the whole time, what are you doing? You're freaking me out. Why are you so nervous? You're sweating. And why are these people staring at us? It was, you know, it was probably less than perfect. But, you know, as I went down on one knee, it ended up pretty perfect. And I remember it fondly, but I was a wreck. Yeah, it was useless.
Very much amazing. How was the skiing season? I mean, I'm following you on Insta, all these great, like the visuals of the gondola and the whole lag.
Well, you know this whole thing, Instagram versus reality?
Yeah.
that's the story of this season.
Not a lot of snow,
no,
right?
No, we had, look, it depends. I mean, high up, there's still fantastic conditions right now, but obviously it's been quite warm over Christmas. It's been very, very... nothing like the Sierras. I think also my last trip to LA, I could actually see the snow from the city properly, right, which looked absolutely beautiful. And I've got 600 inches up in Tahoe and stuff. Nothing like that in Europe, but nevertheless, we're grateful for what it was.
But it looks great. Like the branding looks amazing. And I'm really impressed. I want to go to Lax just to see the gondola and stuff.
You have to.
It really looks
and
insane.
My absolute childhood dream came true a couple of weeks ago when, you know, we christened, we have these snow groomers now that are IWC Big Pilot branded in jet black, which are beautiful, latest model, latest tech. And after I dropped enough hints, they said, okay, you can come on a Saturday and we'll let you drive one, which was something I've been obsessed with these machines ever since I can remember, basically. And there's a opportunity that somebody actually says, okay, get in, have a go. And it's everything I expected it to be. Fantastic machines. Really are.
It sounds amazing. And it sounds funny too, because like one of the things, and there we come together, like Aileen, do you remember that? Let's listen to the episode, like to the part with Aileen. I've laughed so hard listening to that. Like, and she's a Olympic gold medalist in free ski.
Well,
she
wasn't at that point yet, was she?
Okay. But still, I was like, okay, this is just amazing. Let's listen to it.
Do you know what IWC is in Chinese, in Mandarin?
Is it not International Watch Company?
See, we have to ask both things. What's it in the US and what's it in China? Then we know the amalgamation. No, I see my Mandarin obviously is absolutely terrible, but it's supposed to be the watch of many countries, which is something like Wenguo Biao, something like that.
Oh, Wenguo Biao.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That sounds much more convincing than mine. And as I learned the other day, in certain areas of the US, we're now called the IDUB. So there you are. So that's...
Ooh, you're getting nicknames now,
getting
aren't
nicknames.
We?
I think you can wrap that. I think that's the clear benefit of the IDUB.
That's my next project. You can beatbox and I will rap.
Okay.
Yeah. Or would you like the other way around?
No, please.
I can bend to your wishes, please.
Can I DJ in there? Do you need a breakdancer? I don't know.
Absolutely.
Can I join the band? How can I be part of this?
Well, with your dip dye parry t-shirts, I think you're right in there.
I'm trying my best. But I mean, she's such a well-spoken person. It was so interesting.
You know, she is so impressive how she's composed. I mean, she does everything from giving lectures, you know, she's obviously to all her speaker engagements, to her athletic bit, to her modeling. It's very impressive when you think she's about 19, 20 now, which is absolutely crazy when I think back what I was able or unable to do back in those days. She's fascinating, really is fascinating.
Absolutely. And I mean, she was talking about at the age of 14 with her coach let's listen to it. But that was at Watches and Wonder in the special episode, where like it was really, really valuable for me to listen to that and impressive as as she's funny likewise. And very deep too, I would say.
Really proper insight there.
Right. I grew up running my whole life and running was everything to me. My cross country coach in ninth grade, when I was at the state championship meet, I was super, super nervous. And she said, Eileen, just remember when you're super nervous that the chemical in your brain for when you are fearful before a contest is actually the same chemical for excitement. And it's just your brain labeling it in a negative connotation. And I think that that little bit of information and little piece of advice really changed my whole mindset towards dealing with pressure, because all of a sudden I regained control. I thought, okay, I don't feel nervous because I'm out of control. I feel excited because I have worked so hard and I can't wait to show the world what I've been doing all this time.
I mean, I thought several times after listening to that, when I got nervous in other situations, I thought of her and I thought of also the person, the coach, how big the influence of sport and coaches and mentors is in the early years at the age of 14, right? I mean, it was impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And it reminds me of the other episode you had with Hayden Cox, you know, where, you know, again, it was a pivotal moment very, very early on when it's basically Hayden being a boy with a big dream. And then something happened that really shaped his path forever. But let's have a listen to that one.
I broke my surfboard in the summer school holidays, and what a better way to get a new surfboard than build it yourself. So I rang around all the local factories and I found one factory that was willing to take me in my Easter school holidays. And I did 1 week work experience. I was lucky enough to impress the owner of the factory. I swept all his floors, cleaned the toilets just enough to allow him to shape me for me to shape one board in his factory. And from there, I just fell in love with the whole process of designing, building a board, you know, which includes shaping, laminating, and sanding the board, and then going out and surfing it and critiquing your work and that whole design process from start to finish. And the brand Hayden Shapes is pretty much built over the last 24 years, almost 25 years, board by board. And it's still a family-owned business. My wife and myself run it today. And it's, I guess, a true passion of mine. I really get to apply my personal interests into all the areas of the business.
I mean, that's determination and passion and toilets again. It's really impressive. Yeah. I like that episode a lot.
What is very, very impressive with Hayden is the fact that, as he just told, he really started from a pure surfing passion and board shaping perspective, but he very, very quickly developed a extremely strong brand in Hayden Shapes, where every single aspect, you know, talking about toilet details, you know, I stopped in my tracks when my local colleague in Australia at the time, Florian, he showed me pictures of Hayden's showroom that he had in north of Sydney that he had designed himself with his wife. And we went up there and I was completely speechless looking at how much there is control and attention to detail and consistency in a brand built by somebody who just comes from the surfing passion angle and who's got no formal training in luxury branding or anything like that. And suddenly it looks like the most high-end brand you can imagine, super tightly controlled. And then you look at the scalability of how somebody who's basically a one-man show or is a family-owned business is able to scale that brand and now does these huge collaborations with Daniel Arsham and all these different furniture collaborations he does, apparel ranges, branching out to El Segundo internationally, to LA, et cetera, et cetera. And that I think is very fascinating to see how a single person with a dream and passion can actually scale up a business like that and still grow it and still maintaining that personal touch.
Absolutely. And I mean, Giselle was a little bit like that too. Like that's been also, do you remember that episode?
Yeah, I was just wondering how you're going to bridge to that one now, but no, Giselle, obviously, no, amazing story again. I mean, what she's built over the years and her actual, you know, her passion and drive for the environment and sustainability are really, really impressive and touching. And she gave us a very, very strong image of comparing the environment to the human body. Let's have a listen.
There is, you know, it's like your body, for example. We need to understand this. You have lungs, you have a heart, you have all these different organs in your body who are essential for you to be able to function as a human. If they go away and they say, okay, let's remove your lungs, let's remove your heart, that's no you. This doesn't exist. It's impossible. You can't just remove an organ and say, okay, now keep living. This is the same thing as our planet. We can keep eliminating biodiversity and think that we are going to have equilibrium because each system, each being that exists in this planet has a role. It doesn't matter how small or big they are. It's here and it's doing a function that is very important for the balance of life on Earth so we can all continue to be enjoying being in this beautiful planet. And we are on the top of the food chain because we are the ones who have, you know, with technology, with our choices that we really have the impact. The fish or the elephants or they, you know, what are they going to do? You know, like they are just living their lives and we are the ones overfishing. We are the ones, you know, it's all about the lack of consciousness. I think it comes down to that. I think if everybody takes responsibility to understand what the impact they're having and choose companies who are really like doing their processes in a very thoughtful way, now they're voting for a better future. You see, because the corporations are really the ones that are gonna have the bigger impacts because they're the ones that producing everything, right? From food to clothing to luxury.
I mean, it is extremely important, and I'm a little bit proud that we created this platform of the podcast. And sometimes it's funny stories, sometimes it's real personal insights into the stories of the guests. But also, I mean, there's messages like these that are clearly important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And very touching. And we know now it's not up to the elephants. It's actually up to us in industry to make the change. And I think this is something that we always advocate very strongly. You know, we are in a business that is a luxury product designed to last forever. But it also means that we're in a business that charges a premium that allows us to make responsible choices. Right? And this is an ability, but it's also a responsibility because we have to make sure that as we approach our product design, our product distribution, everything around our brand, that we keep improving the way we do things to really maximize the product experience that our customers are receiving and minimizing our impact.
Absolutely. I heard it like you were talking about it, but I feel like I could guess it. But I want to ask.
It's worst kept secret in IWC.
No, but your highlight of the podcast.
Exactly.
What was your personal best? What was the best episode? What was the best moment? What was the highlight? And yes, I agree. Pretty much everybody heard your excitement and heard how stoked you were having Hans Zimmer, I would guess. But tell me about it.
He was somebody else from the Foot Locker at Hauptwache for sure after we found out that he only lived around the corner. But no, of course, Hans has been a childhood and youth hero of mine who really influenced my creativity and influenced the way that I designed and thought about the world, and his music providing really the atmospheric background to a lot of my development in those days. And it is every single time I speak to him, it is fascinating not only how deeply philosophical he is, but also how he is somebody who can really see the bigger picture. And I think this moment that we're going to throw ourselves back to in a second is really a strong example of Hans making a bridge between different worlds and really coming to some quite profound truth about what it is that connects people. Let's have a listen.
All musical instruments are technology. You know, they're technology of that time. But what I think is extraordinary, for instance, the violinist plays a very high note. The quarter of a millimeter to the left or to the right makes the difference between an in-tune note and a dreadful out-of-tune note. So the finesse, the way that things are so small and so precise and have to be, you know, that you literally, you know, you must have it under your fingers. You know, to me, it doesn't sound that different from a watch design, the the refinements that you're constantly talking about, refinements.
Absolutely.
You're constantly talking about refinements in the materials as well. I mean, everybody would love to find that wood that Stradivari used. There are people who are spending their life figuring out what metals to use to build strings, etc. So the watch business and the musical instrument business is driven by people with an enormous passion. And I think partly what happens with the end customer is that the end customer in a concert or by putting a watch on their hand or whatever it is, you know, they feel that they are now part, that they close that circle of passion and imagination.
This is hands down one of the best, deepest descriptions of the customer experience in a passion business I've ever heard. I mean, I'm almost literally speechless.
I am too. Like goosebumps all over.
But let's. I'm still thinking about that one, Paul.
Yeah.
Now, just say let's have a look at. Do you have a favorite moment from various episodes that you hosted? And you hosted quite a few.
Yeah, I
due
did.
To my terrible calendar.
I mean, there's been so many different personalities, but I think I got to go back to George because, like, number one, I'm aware, you know, I still hang with the team and stuff. So like George sometimes, cause he's good looking, he's tall, he's British, he's on pictures. He sometimes looks a little bit like not super nice and friendly, like a little bit too good looking, you know, like a little too James Bond. But, I know him. And he's one of the most kind and personal and sympathetic. Like, he's a really nice guy. And he really talks nice. And he's curious about...
Totally agree.
And he's really a good guy. And the episode that we recorded, it came across how cool he is. And we did, like, you know, he visited Schaffhausen. He visited... we did, like, a soapbox race together. And
yes,
we did a lot of very hands-down things together. And I'm a little bit proud of showing that side, maybe a little bit better than press pictures where he's wearing sunglasses or something. So that's probably my highlight. And one of the stories he told about his youth and how it was growing up on the racetracks was probably my highlight of the whole thing. So let's listen to that part of George Russell and the episode with me.
My older brother is 11 years older than me, and he started go-karting at 10 years old. So I grew up on a racetrack. I used to have this little pedal tractor. I used to pedal around the go-kart tracks on when I was 2-3 years old. And it was quite funny. I used to have this water tanker. I used to put on the back of my pedal tractor, and I used to collect all the water for the go-kart team to fill up their radiators for the engine every day. They'd drain the water, fill up the water, and there's this 2-3-year-old kid going around collecting all of their water for the day in his water tanker. And I also used to collect these old tires I don't know why, it was just on my little trailer. I used to collect these old tires, and my dad, it was a way for my dad just to let me entertain myself, I think. But there was one day he was a bit cross at me because I came back and I didn't realize, but I'd gone into somebody's garage and I'd taken a brand new set of tires that I had no idea were brand new, which were obviously worth, you know, £100 or £200. And I've just effectively stolen this person's brand new set of tires as a 3-year-old kid and brought them back to my father. And there was no way of finding out whose tires they were. So I think I don't know what we did with them in the end. So that was the early days. And then I had, very early days. And then I had a 50cc quad bike from about 4 years old. Before I jumped into a go-kart for the very first time at 7. So I don't know. I look back on these experiences of pedaling my tractor and driving a quad bike around a field, and I really do think it helped me become the driver I am today, because when I jumped in the go-kart for the very first time, it felt natural. You know, I was used to movement. I was used to speed. I was used to controlling something with four wheels and a steering wheel, okay, albeit on a pedal tractor and on a little 50cc quad bike. But I think that was ingrained into my body from the age of two, and it's all I've ever known. So sounds silly, but I do really believe that that helped me when I jumped into a go-kart for the first time.
Ooh, what a
priceless,
nice guy.
Priceless. Yeah, I really and like as a 50th episode special, we can now reveal that we have actually found the tires. So, you know, if you are the owner of this long lost set of tires, DM Paul or I, and we will do a special episode reuniting the poor victim of George's tire theft with their property.
Yeah, perfect. Before we finish, I do ask that one question. Everybody, and I was waiting for this for 50 episodes. Finally, I can ask you, Chris, you have one additional hour of the week. You know, like you have 1 hour extra. What would you do with that hour if you have more time in life?
If I have 1 hour per week, well,
extra.
I could probably just about finish the things that I always promised myself I would finish by the end of the week. And then when that 6, 7 p.m. Friday panic sets in, you never quite make it. And it's so annoying. And you know, Friday, sort of dynamics is when everybody's sort of relieving their conscience of whatever they needed to dump on you. So your in tray is filling up nicely Friday afternoon. I'd love to have 1 hour just to reply to everyone and say, I've seen this, I read it, and here's my feedback. Good luck and happy weekend.
That's very interesting because everybody else was talking about his the things he couldn't do in his private life, like sailing, skiing, and whatever.
You so said you, 1 hour. What kind of sailing or skiing are you trying to do in 1 hour?
Yeah, you have an extra hour. You can start sailing. You can do a little bit of that, but it's very, very interesting. But we have another thing we can reveal too. This is not the last episode. We have some more coming up. Partners in Time is going for another 50 episodes. I don't know. Absolutely. How long are we going to do Absolutely. This, my friend?
That's
Chris?
What we are. That's what we said at the opening of the manufacturing center. Here's to the next 150. So, you know, 50 episodes seems like a smaller task by comparison. So let's go for it.
Yeah, I'm up for it. It's really fun doing this project, and I'm looking forward to seeing you soon, my friend, in Miami probably. Are you in Miami?
Yes, absolutely. We're going to be in Miami. We're going to bring that tractor with the pedalo tractor with the water tank on the back, and I want to see George complete a full lap of the track. It's actually one of the cars that will definitely last for a full lap of the track. No, we want to see that. We're gonna unearth this tractor and hopefully also use that opportunity to invite a special somebody to Miami to reunite them with their long lost tires. So this will be
this is human interaction. I like it. So thanks for doing this and have a great day, my friend.
Thank you, Paul, and you. Speak to you soon.
Always ask one question at the end of each podcast episode over here. What would you do if you would have more time on your hand? Like the day has 6 extra hours, or the week has an extra day, or the month has an extra week. What would you use it for?
I could have like 2 hours more between 1 and 3. I would definitely work these 2 hours and then extend my sleep more into the day.
It's reading more books, because I always feel that I don't have time to read. And every time I open a book, like I learned so much. And
I'll definitely be with my family, with my wife and daughter, probably in Positano.
Is continue my Japanese studies.
You would ask my personal trainer. I'm sure she would say more sports.
I just wish I had way more time to read. I'm reading. I'll spend an extra hour doing whatever that I love to do. Anything besides scrolling on Instagram, I guess. Something valuable. Spend time with my cat, together with my wife.